find out what it's like to experience the world from above. Fly your own drone today. DroneCloneExperts.com specializes in high-quality, affordable drones. Now introducing their Limitless 2 model, equipped with a 4K camera for stunning Ultra HD clarity, GPS with precision auto return, and up to 25 minutes flight time on a single charge. Visit DroneCloneExperts.com now and enter promo code RADIO to receive 15% off your entire order. That's DroneCloneExperts.com.
Hello, Verbal Shenanigans fans. We're excited to welcome a new sponsor to the show. So listen on up. We're embarking on a new year, and that means new sponsors. Since we know many of you are sports fans, you are going to love this. Our newest sponsor of the show is DynastySportsEmpire.com. Say it one more time, DynastySportsEmpire.com. Otherwise known as DSE, they are the world's largest dynasty and keeper fantasy league management company in the world. We're not talking about your cute little home league with Uncle Reno or Draft Queens or FanDouche or one of those other companies. This is real fantasy general managing at its core. If you're tired of your mundane redraft league and have always wanted to retain your amazing team year in, year out, then DSE is where you want to be. They got fantasy hockey and hoops leagues now forming, so visit DynastySportsEmpire.com and see if you have what it takes to conquer their fantasy leagues today. That's DynastySportsEmpire.com. And again, we're very happy to welcome them to the Verbal Shenanigans family. We got a great episode for you today. Go check out DynastySportsEmpire.com.
Hey, Matt, it's Stephen Perkins. I play drums. So do you. And it's been a wonderful time hanging out in Verbal Shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Hey, Verbal Shenanigans back again. Thank you for carving out what is hopefully an hour and a half of your day to join us. Hopefully you're focused. Mike, how do you prefer people to listen to our podcast? When you envision people listening, what do you how do you think they listen?
I'd like to think like they're at a family barbecue. I mean, okay, not now. Okay. But, like, I envision, like, when all is back to normal and all, like, somebody's growing up some brats and, like,
okay, brats,
couple
very
guys
specific.
Are, like,
okay.
Yeah, some guys are, like, drinking beers, you know, the girls are over in the corner having a good time, and just in the background, it's just our pleasant voices going back and forth and all, where somebody turns over to, like, the... you know, the speaker, whatever, and gets that chuckle every now and again. You know what I mean?
So you're picturing more of like we're the background to like a casual entertainment. We're adding an element of fun to an already fun time.
We're more sophisticated Muzak.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, when you go in the elevator to hear the Muzak, you're like, ah. But like when you're at a barbecue and you hear Verbal Shenanigans in the background, you're like, yeah. Like, okay. I imagine at some point one of us say something wacky and like somebody laughs and points at the speaker and turns to somebody.
So, see, I picture the opposite. I picture listeners going to a very specific room in their house, possibly one that they have remodeled over the years, somewhere around episode 50. And it's got the highest quality speakers, the highest quality lounging chair, maybe not even lounging because I don't want anybody to lose attention or get too comfortable. Maybe like a very upright kind of chair where there's no distraction, maybe like a soundproof kind of room. And
okay,
people are leaving their kids, their wives, their jobs. And as soon as it comes out on Monday, usually, you know, usually it's been like Monday night they've been coming out. They say, okay, honey, like, you got to clean the dishes. You got to put the stuff away. You know what time it is. And they focus that hour and a half just solely on us.
So you're basically seeing the gentleman like kissing the wife and like, all right, I'll be back in about an hour and a half. He closes the door. He has like his smoking jacket on. Mm-hmm. Maybe has like a sifter, like a good brandy. Or
yeah,
cognac.
Like a nice bourbon. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and he's just sitting there in front of the fireplace, you know, wafting his drink as he's listening to our daily routine.
Yeah, I'm not even thinking he's not really allowed to have a fireplace because that would provide some kind of distraction. I'm thinking of blackout curtains, no light in the room, just all focus.
So instead of like a relaxing environment, you envision a jail where the person is forcing themselves to listen to us for an hour and a half.
Ironically, that's probably how that's probably how we have to obtain new listeners.
So I envision like a party vibe and a good time. You envision Oz.
Oh yeah, yeah. I picture it would be like say Mike, we needed to get information out of you on like launch codes or something that you were hiding. Like the first step would be, you know, maybe pulling out your fingernails. The next step might be waterboarding. And then, like, the third step would be the Verbal Shenanigans isolation room. That's kind of what I'm picturing. And then you just cough up all the information. Let me out!
Like, any specific episode in question for this torture?
I could think of a few. I could think of a few. I could think of a couple times we had nothing to talk about, or our guest wasn't up to par, if you will. Like I'm thinking Zap from American Gladiators might be one that would really depress people. But I think Al Snow was on that one, so it wasn't a bad episode.
Yeah, Zap seems to be your go-to when you want to tell somebody of like a disappointing episode.
Because here's why: we've had some boring guests, and guys, we're not insulting our guests. We've had a couple boring guests. But I didn't have any expectations going in. I was kind of pumped to talk to an American Gladiator. I thought there was going to be cool stories. It was part of, you know, a lot of this podcast is kind of reaching back and touching upon our childhood and a little nostalgia, you know what I mean? Saturday mornings, I think it was like 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, American Gladiators comes on. You were pumped. And she gave us almost nothing. She sounded depressed the whole time.
I do recall her biggest story she emphasized on was the fact that she was nude in a John Ritter movie. Like, she held on to that story for a while, where she's like, I entered the room and I dropped my robe and John Ritter was staring at my naked body. And I'm kind of like, I wanted to ask you about asphalt or assault.
Yeah.
You know, the one where you shot the tennis balls.
Dude, when you were young, how bad did you want to shoot that tennis ball gun and go through that? The last thing was the gauntlet, right? That was the last event?
The gauntlet, yeah.
Yeah. How bad did you want to do that, man? Like, And then it was like, you know, like Guts came out afterwards, which was kind of like, you know, more for kids. But I always wanted to be on those two shows so bad.
There was a show called Finders Keepers on Nickelodeon I always wanted to do. It was the one where, like, they had like eight different rooms and they would dress it up and then they would give you a clue and then you would have to trash the room to try to find the mystery object.
I don't remember that one. I do remember Legends of the Hidden Temple and then like always laughing that the stupid kid couldn't put that stupid monkey together. It was three pieces and they'd be like fumbling the head and, you know.
I read an article like on the 10th anniversary or something like that. I think like one of the producers really said it, as funny as it sounds, it really was that damn hard, which makes you wonder, I guess they didn't want to give away like the Schwinn bike as like the second prize.
It probably was hard. They probably did some kind of screening and they were like, you know, they gave all the kids like those baby toys. We got to put the square and the square and the triangle. And if they were struggling, they're like, this guy's perfect for Legends. Yeah.
All right. We're putting the thing in the monkey room. Just remember that. Well, actually, you got to put it in the room next to the monkey room. So they're like, all right, I got 2 minutes to grab this and go in. And then it's like, after 90 seconds, it's like, damn it.
Yeah. Just watching some stupid kid jamming the triangle into the square. And they're like, you're part of the Blue Barracudas now.
I was a Silver Snakes kind of guy.
Ah, the Orange Orangutans, I think. Well, but yeah.
Yeah, the Purple Parrots.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember. There was orange iguanas.
Silver snakes, I think, was one.
Yeah, that's the one I brought up. There was a red and a green team, and I don't really recall what they had.
Well, why don't we – let's spend the next 30 minutes until we remember.
Yeah.
What?
We're, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to – Scott described you're doing as you're listening to this podcast, as we do some research on a TV show that probably maybe 20% of you remember. Yeah. I don't know. I'm going to be generous on that number.
Well, anyway, guys, welcome to Verbal Shenanigans. If you're a first time listener, welcome aboard. If you're a long time listener, thank you for returning. Real quick, if it's your first time, we are a show that always brings on interesting guests. In the last few weeks have been amazing. This whole year, really, Berlew has been pretty amazing as far as the guests we talk to. So I don't want to get into that too much. Just go back and look at them. But welcome to the show. We like to talk about life and stupid stuff, and then we play some stupid games, and that's kind of the show. Mike, I did another virtual comedy show this past week. Which is something we offer. We do offer, if you guys are interested in doing something for the holidays, if you will, or doing something for your employees. So this is the same company that hired me. I don't know if it was four or five. I think it was four. I'm not sure. But we started at the beginning of the pandemic. I honestly told the person who asked me if I could do it, I have no clue how this is going to go, but I will do it. We'll give it a shot. Like, I know we talked about this before. And they went surprisingly well, where I've kind of learned, like, an hour is the sweet spot. You don't want to go much longer than that. No one wants to sit in front of their computer. But what was funny, so we're doing the show, and when you're not in the comedy rhythm at all, there's no mics, there's no shows. My last show was a outdoor lake show. I think that was August or something like that. And so that was my last show, not in the rhythm. I do have like new jokes I want to try, or I post like little Facebook jokes that I think could be bits, but you have literally no idea if they work. And you can't find the beats in them, the, you know, what stinks, or too many words. So every virtual show I've had, it is the panic starts like about a week before. I start to get antsy about it. Start to, oh boy, here we go. And it's been the same group. So you got to remember, it's probably the same. I don't know. One time they had like 80 people. The last couple of times are probably like 25 to 40 people. So it's the same cast of characters.
Yeah, you can't just sit back and say, I got my routine.
Exactly.
If you're constantly coming back, it's like, yeah, Tim from accounting is finishing my jokes.
Yeah,
right,
he's heard this before. They start to know your life story. A couple of them have followed Verbal Shenanigans, which is cool.
Ooh.
So you immediately the panic set. It reminds me of very early comedy days, like kind of like freaking out, oh my set, like worrying way too much about something that's going to be over quickly. And if it goes bad, the worst nice thing about virtual shows is if you bomb, you hit exit on the Zoom room and you like go back to washing the dishes. You're not traveling down Route 80 an hour and a half drive, listening to Johnny Cash's Hurt at full volume, crying, thinking about why you didn't go to trade school. You're not doing that.
See, if I'm starting to bomb and it's early, let's say like you give me like 10 minutes and we're like three in, I'm just going to accidentally hit the mute button and just act like I have this old hack. Like I'll be my arms like I'm telling a story or something like that. Just so it's like you'll drop me off. And then I'll have the laugh of, I didn't have to finish my horrible set. And two, I just gave you an extra 7 minutes you have to fill.
So you're going with the technical difficulty angle. Like, oh, sorry, yeah, my computer dropped out.
If I'm going to die, I'm dragging people with me. And Berlew, it's the host of the show.
Berlew, if you were bombing, you should just go right to taking off your pants again and doing frog jumps. frog jumps in your boxers.
That could work. I could see that.
That would kill.
Is this interpretive dance? What are we looking at here?
Oh, God. Oh, God. Tune into last week's episode to kind of hear what that was all about. But so it's a medical like supplier company there. And I don't even know if I ever told this, but if I did, whatever. Bro, did I ever tell you how I got these shows?
If you did, you might as well remind me and our listening audience.
So here's a way, weird way the universe works. So I don't know if you remember, like when Facebook first started, it was kind of like you needed a college ID to get into Facebook. Like you needed an email. I don't know. It was like kind of fun to like find people with the same name as you. And I found a Scott Brennan from Penn State and we like became friends. And
now I remember the story, but continue.
Yeah, it's a pretty funny story. So 15, 16 years later, whatever it is, I get a message. We've been following each other. No other interaction. No like, hey, how you doing? Like, but we've been following each other for all these years. And he reached out to me and he's like, hey, my company is looking for entertainment. I see you do comedy. Long story short, that's how I got the gig, which is, it just goes to show you, you literally never know. You just never know. So 4 or 5 shows later, we're still doing it. But so we're doing the show. I go up, I do okay. I tried a whole bunch of new baby material, if you will, dad material. A couple landed, a couple definitely did not land. And when it doesn't land in a club or a show, you get that nice couple people. You can see people's faces. When it doesn't land in a Zoom room, you don't know. you kind of talk yourself like, oh, maybe they didn't hear me. maybe their mics aren't on. But a couple, woof, did they fell on deaf ears. That's for sure. There's specifically 2 bits that I can remember that I'm like, well, that needs some work.
By any chance, when the show was over, did you go upstairs and take it out on the baby? Like, did you start yelling at your 1-month-old? And I thought you were going to add to my life.
I literally birthed you for a new 15 minutes of material. You know, well, I didn't birth him, but
you pooped all over my couch and nobody thought that was funny. Good job, Shay.
Well, but I'll get that in a second. So what was funny is so the first comic that goes on was Joe Fernandez, a good friend of the show, and he's doing really well. And everybody has like a different approach too in the Zoom shows. Like I try to do it because I'm like a big pansy. I still put out a mic stand and a mic that aren't even hooked up. The mic is not actually hooked. It's just like, it's like my blankie. You know what I mean? And it's like, it's kind of the illusion of a comedy show, you know?
Kind of get yourself in the environment to get your vibes and juices flowing.
It's funny because I've been on shows where the sound would go out and, people would just deliver it without a mic. Like for some reason that petrifies me, not having the mic in my hand. I don't know what it is, but it's just, maybe I'm so used to it and I kind of use the mic a lot.
I mean, if you look at it, like the stand-up comedians who do host SNL, when they do their monologue, they always have that microphone in their hand. So it's not off the wall. Like Bill Burr and Chappelle, they right. both demand a mic when they do their monologue. So
I can't do
something you used to.
I can't do this. And if you're listening on audio, like I can't do like just the hand motions. Like I feel like I don't know where to put my hands. The mic over the years has become more of like I'll even lean on the mic stand sometimes and use the mic stand. Like I need something in my hands for some reason. But so Joe's doing his set, if you will. And he, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, a screen pops up, like a shared screen on the Zoom room. And I'm like, huh. I panic thinking I shared, like I hit the share screen button. And I'm looking, and it's someone's medical bills. It's literally like, let's say, John Smith, age, blah, 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 hospital stay. Blah, and not only is it up, they started scrolling through it, meaning the guy in charge of the show was probably like, I don't want to listen to this. I'm going to get some work done. And all of a sudden I start to see the, now, because I'm off camera now because Joe's on, and I start seeing faces like, oh, like people going, oh no, oh no. And Joe's like plowing through jokes, kind of not really knowing what's going on, because he, you know, you're not looking at the screen per se. You're kind of looking for reactions. And all of a sudden he's like, wait, what's going on? And someone's like, I think someone's personal information is up on the screen. And turns out it gets the biggest laugh of the night. It gets by far the biggest laugh of the night.
See, I think I would use that. That's almost like the new crowd work, where it like comes up and like, well, what's this Tim Smith into? Where'd you get chlamydia, Tim? Like, I would just be plowing into that.
Yeah. Oh, bring it back up. Bring it back up, please.
Yeah. Wait a minute. Who else in the office got chlamydia? Hold up.
So, really weird, awkward moment, but has, you know, you just roll with it and you laugh about it. In fact, it kind of adds to the show a little bit. So that goes on, and it's just so funny. Like, people, there's little things that happen in these Zoom shows that are funny. Like, people don't change their names sometimes. Like say we were on a Zoom call, me, you, and our friends, and you change your name to like the Burles or something like that. You know, just messing around. So people enter these work Zoom calls with weird names. So one woman was named, let's call her Jenny Thompson, and then it's Jenny Thompson - Shark Enthusiast. So,
like, is that her opener to introduce herself to people? Like, if she's in a bar or something, whatever, she's doing like one of those minute dating things. It's like, hey, how's it going? I'm Jenny. Let me tell you 12 shark facts.
Well, it's funny because right away, like, and then, you know, we enter before the show and our cameras are off. That's kind of how I do the show. And then, like, I'm up. And then, Mike, if you're next, I introduce you. And then you turn your camera on and you become the presenter. So that's kind of how I run the show. And it works really well, actually. So no one steal that. That's my thing. No.
Scott Brennan, king of the Zoom.
Let me tell you, man, during this stuff, if I could get one of those a week, I would be a happy guy. Just to try jokes and... they pay all right, to be honest. But anyway, so I'm also listening to their conversation before that. So one woman, so we have the shark enthusiast, which right away I'm going to go in on. Then one guy is just sitting there holding his kid like this, just bouncing him up and down in the camera, and like everyone's laughing. I'm like, this kid is killing, and he can't say a word. Then,
which is odd because I know some comedians who can't say a word and they don't do as well.
Oh God. I mean, that kid did way better than I did. I will tell you that. And then there's a, then there's a person sitting there talking, going like, this is the conversation I'm hearing. They're like, oh yeah, I figured out what's wrong with my dog. And I'm like, oh no. Like, what's wrong? I found out his phobia is he's afraid of cardboard boxes. And there was some name for fear of cardboard boxes. And so right away, I'm listening to all these things. And my set just, I didn't get to any jokes for 6-7 minutes because I'm just addressing the weirdness. Turns out the shark enthusiast, legit shark enthusiast, like one of those weird kind of like, super hyper focused people that kind of you like you regret instantly calling on them. I'm like, oh, and there's a Jen Smith over there, shark enthusiast, huh? What the hell is that? And then she's like, well, and, you know, like, kind of short of breath because she was like ready to. Oh, well,
she literally attacked you like a shark.
Yeah. Yeah. And she starts rattling off shark facts. I'm like, oh my God. And then I'm like, well, I'm like, don't talk to Jen on Shark Week because she's alone in her house, like getting a little crazy. And then she goes, actually, Shark Week is, I don't like Shark Week. It promotes the danger of sharks and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, whoa.
Yeah. You know, there was a coworker the second you brought up sharks, they're like, God.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to step away for a beer. I'll be back in 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jenny.
Yeah. So all in all, it went well. Tracy Locke, very good comedian, just murder. Like, it's so interesting to see someone murder virtually. I don't even know how to explain it, but like, you see the whole gallery view on Zoom, and you see people actually like laughing in their living rooms. It's a pretty cool sight, because it just means that, you know, what it does mean is that people want entertainment still. They want something to do, you know, and you see these parking lot shows and you see all this other thing. And it's so easy to knock it, but it is like the only thing keeping this like art form, if you will, like alive. So it's really interesting. Like if you, I feel like if you could murder in a Zoom room, you can murder anywhere.
Well, I think we've had this discussion before, like on some of these shows. I think the best thing to go into these is don't expect anything, but go in there to destroy. Because if you get the confidence there, like when you go back to your regular stage where you're comfortable there, there shouldn't be anything stopping you from like going to a new level from there.
And I think like Berlew, if you were still doing comedy, I think you would get so much out of doing the Zoom thing, because it just teaches you that, I don't know, it just teaches you, it's taught me a lot. Like, it's taught me to relax and like those people are, there's a reason they're on the Zoom room, right? There's a reason they're hanging on to hang out for an hour. And like, even if the jokes bomb, like, it's kind of like fun to like play around with and just be like, dude, we haven't been doing comedy for 8 months. Like, and they kind of like laugh at it. It's like, that's brand new. And they're like, oh yeah, we know. And it's just like a fun kind of back and forth. It just teaches you to be way more aware of, I guess, your stage presence, or that things really aren't that serious. And I think once I get back on stage one day, it's a really nice thing to remember. Like, it's not that serious, man. And bombing it's okay. Just like, have fun with it, you know? It's not this stressful thing. It's like, everyone bombs. Everyone.
When you consider we performed in a vapor room with two people and then had a male stripper review on Super Bowl Sunday, Zoom doesn't come up as the most odd thing to perform on.
Not at all. And what's really cool, so before we get to our guest, so the shows have been going so well that today I'm sitting and I get a call and it's got something something Tennessee on it. And 9 out of 10 times I would never pick up the phone. You know, I'm just like, some junk call. Pick it up, I go, hello. And they're like, hey, my name is Kelly, and someone from your Zoom comedy show recommended my company to do the same thing. We're really interested. We want to do something for our employees. And sure enough, I just booked another Zoom comedy show in December for a company in Tennessee.
Look at you. Look at you.
It's just interesting. It's like, And I told her honestly, I said, she's like, so what do I expect? I said, look, it's not going to be this rip-roaring comedy club, but it is going to provide some entertainment. And I said, I never thought in a million years I'd be saying this to you. And I told her, I said, I never thought in a million years, like, usually I'd be like, nah, not going to do it. And, you know, I don't think... I think these are here to stay. If you do them right, I think people are going to do these after the pandemic. Like, hey, like, listen, Mike, like, say you were working till 5 o'clock, and the boss said, okay, guys, on Thursday, instead of working, we're going to do a comedy show for for an hour, and everybody gets to hang out and pour themselves a beer. I think this is a different way to approach the possibility of entertainment. Like, I really think these are going to stay for a little while.
If anything, it could be like a discount of like bringing in a bunch of comedians into like the office and doing it that way. Cause you've got to figure, try to bring in three people for a few hours. I mean, that's going to cost them like in the multiple hundreds of dollars. This is probably a better discount.
Yeah. I mean, and in the first show, I had a Zoom meeting with the comics. It was Jackie Byrne and Mark Rigadon and Kevin. And it was like, we were like scared stiff about it. We're like, I don't know how it's going to go, but I was like, I'll pay you. So don't worry about it. And now I'm like not even worried about it. I'm like, if you're a good comic, you can figure this out. So for anybody listening out there that's doing comedy or music, or if you're doing, I don't know, if you're a freaking artist and you want to do some kind of share and comment, or a poet, I have no idea, but it is possible. That's kind of the point of this. It really is possible to at least provide some entertainment. Is it what you want? Hell no, it's not what you want, but it is a way to keep it alive. So,
yep. And the most important thing from the story to remember is papyrophobia is the fear of cardboard.
That's what it was. Yep. Like papyrophobia, something like that. And I'm like, wow, this is where we're at. So we have a killer guest tonight. He is a world-class drummer. He is played with some of the biggest bands you've heard of, such as Porno for Pyros, and just this tiny little band called Jane's Addiction. And he is Stephen Perkins. And the guy is really awesome, really unique, and just such a talented drummer. So I'm very excited to get him on the line. So without further ado, here is Stephen Perkins.
Hey, fellas.
Steven, what's going on, man?
Steven.
Good afternoon. How's my mic? I just turned it on.
It sounds pretty good to me.
Sounds
good.
Great.
Volume?
Yeah.
Not too much?
Yep. Yeah, right. Definitely. Steve, that's Mike, and I'm Scott, and thanks for giving us a few minutes, man.
Yeah, let me just check this light a little bit higher. A little bright on the forehead? How's that?
You look great.
You're great.
You look stunning. Okay.
Yeah, you know, I got one of those five heads.
Dude, I'm with you, pal. I got a big Irish melon here. Let me trust me.
You know, in high school, I was voted most likely to recede.
Steven,
you kind of look like you got like a mohawk going there, though.
A little bit of a hawk, and then I've got my Tannoy speakers. These are the speakers we mix Nothing Shocking on.
Really?
That's unbelievable. Awesome. I got an amazing amp called the Parasound amp, and then these Tannoys. You know, everyone's listening to music on their phone, and I'm still I want to hear some balls when I hear my music, man.
I agree. Like I listen on my phone like too much, and even just like, you know, it's headphone.
So simple.
And know. Then when you listen on like a good stereo, you're like, wow, I kind of missed this. You know, you're like, I missed this, the highs and the lows that you completely missed.
Exactly.
Everything's so compressed.
The full frequency, the you know, the mids and the lows, you're not going to get on a phone. You'll get plenty of highs.
Yes, treble. Yeah. But Stephen, it really is it's an honor to speak to you. It's cool, you know. You've had several iterations of your music that I have listened to throughout my life. So it's really cool to get to sit down and talk with you. I guess I'll start in the present time. We've been talking to a lot of musicians during this pandemic and whatnot, and we're finding a lot of really cool and a lot of cool art is coming out of it, and a lot of people are writing and whatnot, and then some people are also kind of miserable and finding writer's block and can't, you know, they're not inspired and they've lost their tours. And I'm curious how you've been dealing with as a musician, as an entertainer, during this time, during this break of obviously live stuff. Have you committed to writing? What's your process been?
Well, you know, with technology, I'm really taking advantage of the home studio I have, and I'm doing a lot of file trading where someone will send me a tune, and usually just a click track, no drums, no notes, and I can go to town here at my studio. I've got timpanis and gongs and drum set and hand drums. And so that has been quite a fun creative time for me to be alone with tracks. It's, you know, it's different not to be able to bounce off people and get that immediate reaction and have that spontaneous mistake happen and then make that the most important part of the tune when something by accident somehow unfolds.
Right.
But it is it's been a creative time here at the house. And as far as feeding my soul, I always think about the 50s when rock and roll just started and people were dancing and thin, you know, Miss Dizzy, Thin Lizzy, and, you know, splishing in the bath and yeah, dancing around the clock.
Twisting the night away.
It was a good time, you know, and they were celebrating after WW2 and everybody in America had, you know, washing machines and refrigerators and cars. It really wasn't until the 60s in America, at least, when Vietnam hit, the music went dark. And you had the Grateful Dead and the Doors and Jefferson Airplane and Lou Reed in New York. And a lot of things were happening because of their friends were going to Vietnam and not coming back. So the music started reflecting that. Now, if you think about what came out of England, they were still living in WW2 rubble. You know, their cities really weren't built up very quickly and people didn't have much like we had in America to pull from. So their music was dark immediately. And you had, you know, Cream. And of course, you know, the Beatles and the Stones, they had happy moments, but there was a darkness to it.
Right.
And the Animals. But I think when things go dark, you're going to have this light at the end of the tunnel of great novels and painting and photography and movies and music and lyrics and poems. And I'm hoping that this will be the time where we kind of go introvert, take this pain and this uncertainty and this friction and all this division. And hopefully from there, we can come up with some really deep art.
I think it's got layers
and layers, and you can really dig through it. And there's nothing wrong with swing music in the 40s because, you know, the WW2 was over. You had Benny Goodman and you had all these great dance songs. And then rock and roll hit and people were just having a good time in the high school and teenagers. But there is something to say about, you know, it, not that it was safe in the last 5 or 6 years, but there's a lot of repetitive music and a lot of stuff sounded the same. And I'm hoping now there'll be something very diverse coming out of this. And, you know, as a drummer, I'm an athlete. I like to hit things.
Yeah.
I've got this romance of my sticks in my hands and hitting something. So I've got a lot feeding that energy right now. And it's, you know, I try to turn the negative into positive as far as putting it into my drumming and rhythms. And, you know, as a young man, I loved jazz drummers because they were so creative and every drummer sounded different. But no one in my world was playing jazz. Everybody played rock and roll. And I loved rock, but I couldn't find anybody that played piano or saxophone or flute or trombone.
Right.
It was a guitar with a Marshall stack and a bass with an Ampeg rig. And so, you know, there's that sense later on as I got a chance to meet new musicians and find out, maybe I can play with a saxophonist and an upright bass player. Okay, I got to learn about dynamics. There's nothing amplified, you know, and now people are using, you know, the technology today, and this incredible drum rhythms are coming out of a computer. How do I compete with that? So I have to get into that mindset.
Right.
And
yeah.
You know, in the 80s, when New Wave was really popular, I loved a lot of the bands and a lot of the drum tones were incredible, but I was really attracted to new wave bands that had real drummers, B-52s, The Cars, you know, even Peter Gabriel, Missing Persons with Terry Bozzio. They were playing new wave music, but they had a natural drummer playing the rhythms. So I love that hybrid. So I'm looking, even in the studio here today, I've got my electric drum kit and my keyboards, but I've also got my drums and I want to be able to hybrid that together.
Yeah.
And I think in a large scale, just like kids today are online doing school and they're not on the play yard bumping into each other and making friends, you have to learn how to marry technology with the human heart somehow. Mm. And so that's really, you know, I think I've been learning how to do that better and better. And taking this energy, like I said, this friction that we all feel, and hopefully channel it into some good music and good art and let that reflect, you know, and it is a reflection of what we're going through. It goes right into the music. And, you know, some of my favorite drummers sometimes don't play in the greatest bands because they're just so fantastic. The band is almost, you know, secondary. And then the music to me becomes more important as I discover the band. So I'm looking forward to hearing what happens post COVID.
I agree.
And we can get together and make music together in a room, you know?
Yeah.
Fascinating. Let's go back to your early beginnings. From what I've read up, and you got your first drum set the day after your bar mitzvah. When you get these drums, and all, what are you exactly doing? Are you just like releasing energy playing? Are you like trying to read up how to play drums? Are you like trying to replicate one of your heroes? How do you start your process?
Yeah, I mean, all of it was part of it. But, you know, when I was 8 years old, I got drumsticks and a little pad, and I played pillows and pads. And I learned how to bounce off those surfaces. And then I got a drum set, and I had to learn how to bounce off these new surfaces of drums and tom-toms and cymbals and discover my hips and ankles and feet working the pedals. And I learned about the instrument. And so it was using that technique and the rudiments, which is, it's an honorable way to start, because the greatest musicians ever started with the same rudiment books that I started with.
Right.
Buddy Rich and Gene Krupa. We all learned Max Roach. We all learned how to do paradiddles and 5-stroke and 7-stroke rolls. So there's this honor to learn how to do it like they did it. But then there's this homegrown urge to be yourself. And when I got my first drum set, that's when that homegrown feeling came in. There was a sense that I needed to replicate my heroes, but I could never sound just like them. I could figure out their patterns, but it was either the recording or the understanding of pulling and pushing time signatures, and all that was so new to me. So it was this exploration. It was another level. It was pads and pillows, and then the drum set, and putting on records and playing to the records. And then what a turn on it was when my friends or family would come over and I put on a record and play to them with them and show them and see their reaction. And that gave me some more juice to, oh, this is exciting. I'm getting not only this internal growth, but I'm watching my friends enjoy this. And, you know, and then finding musicians. I met Dave Navarro when I was 14, finding people that played music and had a similar record collection. And we'd go through, you know, the Zeppelin or the Sabbath or the Rush, and we try to play like these guys. And, you know, realizing we're only 15, 14, we never could, but it was our quest. It was the goal line to learn how to play Tom Sawyer in 1980.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And it didn't really ever sound like them, but we tried. And then being in the marching band, that changed everything, because I thought I had some chops until I was surrounded by 10 other drummers that had the same chops. So I'm not so special. So what do I do then? You know, and it's about your environment, the records you collect, the discipline and the time you put into it. And also the people you play with. I always look for people that were better than me. Just like a tennis player needs another great tennis player to rally with. If he's serving and the guy can't get a serve back, that's not a game.
Yeah.
So there was so many things that were so, I guess, had to be discovered in my musical world, not only playing the drums with the sticks bouncing off the head, but how to play with people, how to listen to people, how to find people that are into the same music. Hopefully they're better than me so they can pull me forward and challenge me, you know?
Well, I mean, that kind of segues into, you know, you have played with, you know, you've been with Jane's Addiction and Porno for Pyros, but you've played with the likes of Nine Inch Nails and the Chili Peppers and Rage Against the Machine and, you know, some of these just amazing artists. And, you know, I'm curious, like, you know, you work with Perry, and what was it like to work with Trent, and what was it like to work with Zach? Like, is there a guy that stands out to you that was so completely different the way he worked than all the others? Or do you take like every one of those experiences and pull from everybody that you work with?
Absolutely. I mean, we all, you know, when I get in a room with a musician, I try to start fresh. Of course, I think about the history and the reputation they bring to the room.
Right.
But I also want to show them this new experience. What's it like to play with me? Because I know they've played with other drummers. and everybody brings something to the table a little different. So I just wanted to show my original, you know, sensitive side of listening and playing along with them and also being very reactive. And, you know, I love Motown drumming, but it's kind of like just this anchor that sits in one place. Jazz drummers react off each other.
Right.
And Mitch Mitchell from Jimi Hendrix, he's a jazz drummer. He's reacting. John Densmore from The Doors, he's always reacting off everybody. And so that was the point when I got in a room with Lou Reed or Trent Reznor, or if I had one wonderful day when I spent with Mick Jagger playing all day.
Oh, that's awesome. Wow.
I was thinking to myself, yes, this is Mick Jagger. But then again, I'm also thinking, what do I need to do in this moment to get his ass moving? And Charlie Watts, you know.
Now, does it take a lot to get Jagger moving, or is it just instant? Like, is it?
Well, it was a big band, actually. There was a piano player, a keyboardist, a horn section, bass player, two guitar players, backup singers, and Mick. And so there was a lot going on, but I did focus on the way Mick moved, the way he used his voice and the patterns that he would use for the syllables and you know, the energy or the dynamic he would use to sing these moments. And I would try to just capture and hone in on that. You know, it reminds me of going on a date with a girl. You know, she's been on a date with other guys and she's been in many restaurants and many movies, but I want to show her my style of taking her out, where my favorite restaurant, my favorite movie theater, you know, my drive on Mulholland Highway and what the greatest view is of LA. So I tried to get this personalized, I guess, in a sense, give him a postcard from my heart in a way, and give Mick Jagger the real me and give Trent Reznor the real me. And also listen, what do they want from me? What do they, you know, every comment they say, take it and use that to my advantage to make a better experience for everybody. And, you know, playing with Lou Reed or Mick Jagger or Ozzy Osbourne is fantastic. It's unbelievable. But also playing with a 20-year-old kid who's just up and coming is also the same experience. You know, I want to do those same things for that moment. And I think, you know, I think one of my favorite moments ever was with Lou Reed. We worked on a song, me and the bass player, for about 3 hours before we got there. And we perfected it in our mind. He showed up and he said, oh, I don't play it that way anymore. This is the way I play it. Different tempo, different tuning. And so I was just like, okay, cool. This is a wonderful moment for me to be fresh and actually start something brand new with Lou and not try to replicate what I heard on the record over and over. But let's see what happens today with the tune. And he taught me a big lesson, you know, be in the moment. Don't try to, you know, replicate what happened in 79 in New York City. It's 1994 and we're in California. What do you bring to the table? So that's, I think, you know, to be in that moment is really the most special thing you can do as a musician, is to be aware, to be alert, and also not think about the past or the future. You know, it's like dancing. You can't think about the song about to end. You're just dancing to that beat at that second, and then, you know, something's going to come around the corner, but don't predict it. Just move.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit when you joined Jane's Addiction. I mean, everybody associates you as a drummer. Technically, you came in replacing another guy, from what I read, just didn't show up for rehearsals. I'm just kind of curious, like, what did that? Was that opportunity, were you going into it saying, okay, this is going to be my big break, or was it just like another gig? And kind of talk about how you brought Dave Navarro into the band.
Well, me and Dave had a high school band called Disaster, and that was 81, 82, 83, 84. And we actually were obsessed with the Sunset Strip. We'd go there and watch bands, and we think all you have to do is put flyers up, book a gig, and get on stage. That's what they did. So we were doing gigs at the Troubadour and the Roxy and the Whiskey and all these great LA spots. And we actually saw Jane's Addiction play. My girlfriend at the time, her older brother is the bass player, Eric Avery. And so Perry was 26, Eric was 24, and me and Dave were just 17. And their drummer was in another band called KFK. And he was certain that KFK was the next big thing. So he said, I'm going to go with KFK. And Perry and Eric started auditioning drummers, but drummers their age, in their 20s. And Eric talked to his younger sister, and she said, you know, my boyfriend plays drums. Huh. He's a maniac. You should try him out. And I got to hand it to Eric and Perry for letting a 17-year-old join a band. Because when you're in your mid-20s, are you interested in that? Because a 17-year-old usually is about flash and showing off the chops and maybe not so honed in on songwriting yet. But I showed up with my Keith Moon-sized drum set. And I actually have a tape recording of that, if you want to call it an audition, of the jam. The guitar player at the time was a guy named Ed. And we played, you know, some of the Jane songs. And I just went for it. I gave him everything I had. And, you know, the next day they said, you're our man. Let's make some music together. And we actually cut a demo with Ed. And I kept telling the guys, my best friend Dave, you know, Ed's great, but you got to hear my friend Dave, man. This guy's out of sight. And it took about 3 weeks and Dave showed up. And I think the first tune we played with Dave was Pigs and Zen and then Whores. And that's the sound you hear on Triple X, the live record, is what we sounded like that night. There was energy. There was spontaneity. There was guitar solos and drum fills. And then again, this great song that Perry and Eric would write, because they were influenced by Joy Division and Bauhaus and Echo and Susie. There wasn't much flash, but there was this wonderful unit. These songs and these bands had a unified sound. But me and Dave were still into Scorpions and Maiden and Van Halen, where there were a lot of chops, a lot of playing. And I think that was the moment where Jane's had this marriage of darkness and honoring the song. And also this flash of light that me and Dave brought of you know, it's like a firework. And then there's big events have to happen all the time. That's what me and Dave thought. And, you know, there was a great scene in L.A. It was not only what was going on in the Strip that me and Dave were involved with, but the Strip would end at midnight or 1 a.m. The downtown scene, the late after, you know, the late night after hours, that would start at 1 a.m. And you had the Chili Peppers and X and Fishbone and Minutemen who would turn into Firehose and all these great bands that me and Dave were not really that aware of. And, you know, Flag and Circle Jerks and Dead Kennedys. But this was all very late night. You know, me and Dave were the youngest ones around by far.
Yeah.
And we were also the most obsessed with our instrument, because that scene was more about attitude and less about playing with finesse, even though they all had it. Me and Dave brought something that was quite new to that scene. And that's how the door opened. And if you listen to the earlier Jane's tunes with Pigs and Zen and Idiot's Rule and Had It Ad, there was this unified sound in LA with the Chili Peppers and Fishbone and Minutemen. It was funky.
Right.
And it had a sense of humor. It took a minute before we found Then She Did in 3 days and some of the songs that were more the darkness of Jane's Addiction. And we definitely cut ourselves away from this LA pie that was happening, but it was a great family of musicians and artists and filmmakers. And it was a late night scene. And I think that little spark that me and Dave brought, and that new friendships of all those new musicians we met, and we never thought about the Strip again. We never even thought the Sunset Strip was, you know, valid anymore. It just had nothing to do with us. We were past it, and we were, you know, accepted in this new scene, and we embraced it, and they embraced us.
Yeah. You know, does it blow your mind a little bit? Like, I was thinking about this in a couple of years that Jane's Addiction has been around for almost 40 years. Does that like melt your brain apart, or does it feel that long?
Well, there's two stories there. Yes, it feels like a very long time. These are my oldest friends, Perry and Dave, and made more music and been on stage with them more than anybody. And, you know, all those early nights and days of us going out and hanging and talking about music and seeing movies and just, you know, this young friendship blossoming. But then again, of course, decade after decade, you know, and all the changes and all the musicians I've played with since then, and had my chance to play with some fantastic bass players, with Mike Watt and Rob Wasserman and Flea and Les Claypool and Tony Franklin, all these great musicians and guitar players, unbelievable players around, you know. But my heart still feels the fullest when Perry says 3, 4 bam.
Yeah.
And that's, and I do, I feel like a 17-year-old when we do it. But I think, again, you know, I'm 53, but music keeps me young and drums keep me young. And without it, I think I'd be quite lost without those friendships and that connection to the lyric.
Yeah.
Because Perry never had a verse, chorus, bridge, chorus, chorus out. He had a poem.
Right.
And we write music around these poems. If you think about the song Stop, there is no chorus. There's two verses, a guitar solo and a vocal break. And that's how we looked at the music. Let's embrace the poem and write a song around it. I think my favorite moment for Ritual is Then She Did, because the poem and the music just go perfectly hand in hand. Same with 3 Days. It starts off as a ballad and he's lighting candles and he's getting ready for the night with his girls. And then they start making love and we go tribal. And then they climb, you know, and they climax and we solo, you know?
Yeah.
And then the big argument, if there's three people in a bedroom, someone's going to get the short end of the stick, you know, and then it gets rusty. And so the music really embraces the poem. And yeah, it does feel like many, many years of, I guess, dedication to the band. And I always look at Metallica and the Chili Peppers and some bands that never stopped. And it's a little bit of jealousy. I wish Jane's had 20 records.
Right.
But then again, it worked out just fine. Everyone's happy. We're still friends. And it's the way it's supposed to be, you know?
You know, I was listening, you know, just today. I knew we were doing the interview and listening to some Jane stuff. And the live version of Jane Says comes on, which arguably is one of the best live versions of any. To me, it's always better. I think it's better than the recorded version. And I was starting to think, like, you're a drummer, but you're also a percussionist, and the big part of that version is the steel drums. Was that you?
Of course.
Was that your idea? And like, what?
Yeah,
like,
I mean, like, we did Jane Says on the Triple X record,
right?
And I just played bongos. But when we started doing Nothing Shocking, that was our first real experience to have time in a studio. We did a demo. It took 2 days. Now we got 2 months in a studio, and we used the studio as an instrument. We explored not only just put some mics up and play the songs, but now let's salt and pepper the tunes with the studio. And we were bringing in sitar and timpani and, you know, and everything you can think of. We had Flea and Angelo come in and play horns on Idiot's Rule. And then when we got to Jane Says, you know, we did the bongo version, and I thought, I'm going to lay a kick and snare and have some backbeat.
Yeah.
And I mean, we were definitely this thread of reggae and even what Bad Brains was doing, the marriage of this Jamaican earth connected to hard rock music. And you can hear that in Ted Just Admit It, this unbelievable dubstep moment. You know? Yep. And so we would explore, you know, how to make these songs like an onion and give them layers and give them different melodies and give them different textures. And I can't recall the day we went, me and Dave Jordan, the producer, we went to find some percussion, and we found this. Now that I look back at the steel drum, it's kind of a C-. It's not the greatest steel drum. I've got a really beautiful one now from Trinidad. But the one we used on the record was, you know, just like it was an amateur steel drum. But I wrote this beautiful piece with the help of Dave. Dave played the guitar riff over and over. And I found this melody on the steel drum. And, you know, no one knows what's going to stick when you start mixing, because you do all these great things, especially if you have 2 months in the studio. You throw everything into the recording and then you mix it. You find out what works, what edits, gets out, what mutes, you know, what do you need to do to make the song stand up? And, you know, that's how it came about. It was this search for different layers.
It's still so good.
Each song.
It's still so good, man. It still holds up. Like, you know, I put it on, it's on my playlist and barbecues, and it's just always there. And it's just,
you
like,
know, and those, and the same thing with the lyrics, you know, it's a poem about a friend. But it's also, you can relate, a lot of people can relate to it, and you don't have to be kicking heroin to relate to it. There's a lot of things in your life that you don't need anymore. You're trying to get rid of them and you can't. And that's what it felt like with the lyrics. And also this unbelievable feeling when we play that live, I get to go up with the boys and be up front.
Yeah. And
as a drummer, you know, you pick your instrument, you know, you're in the back. There's something great about being up front and getting eye to eye with the audience and seeing people sing that song, and the lyrics are touching, and then people really are touched by that song. And it's fun to get up there with the fellas and play it.
It's so good.
Front stage.
Like growing up 17 years old, going to the Roxy and all the big time venues. Do you still get the same feeling when you go take that act to like a big stadium kind of atmosphere, or is it change in any way?
Absolutely, man. I mean, what I love about the big, big rooms is you don't know and you can't see what's happening out there. And people are having this great experience. You're just the soundtrack. And when you play a small room, most of the people there are there to see the band. They know every lyric. And at an outdoor festival, it could be a 3-day festival. Someone's doing a bungee jump at the end of the football field and someone's on a Ferris wheel. They didn't come to see you, but they can't get away from the sound. Yeah. It's there, you know, and you're imprinting your music into these people that maybe or may or not be there to see you. But the feeling I get sitting at my drum set, a big room or a small room, is still that romance I mentioned earlier with me and the sticks and my three or four friends up there, you know. But I love the power of those big stadiums. And I love when I went to shows in L.A. and if it was Supertramp and Queen and, you know, all these different great big venues that I would go see these bands in. It was just, it almost felt like we're part of the same, you know, there's this party where everyone is there for the same reason. And it's such a great unifying feeling. And you listen to the music on the way to the gig and you listen to the music on the way out and everyone's wearing the t-shirt. And I love, it's like a, you know, it's like a great sporting event, you know, it's really this great, you know, there's a camaraderie to it. But also like a small venue, there's something so intimate and like a phone call and you're in a quiet room, you can talk and you hear everything. But if you're in a room that's crowded, you might be talking and then go, hey man, hey, oh, hold on a second. And you get distracted.
Yeah.
Because there's things happening. So those big shows, there's distractions. It doesn't make the show better or worse, but you get distracted from the moment. And you see someone, hey man, what's up? Oh shit, I'm back in the song. And I also think it's great for the audience when you do those big festivals, because if the Foo Fighters and the Deftones and all these bands are watching, it's a competitive spirit. So that you are there competing with each other. The audience gets a better show because everyone wants to throw their best thing at the audience. And also everybody around gets to watch you do it. I remember when Porno for Pyros did a great gig. It was Prodigy, Rage, Hole, New Order. And they were all there on the side of the stage watching. I don't think we ever played better. You know, I mean, they inspired us to play even better than a regular show would have happened.
That's awesome. Steven, we're coming up on our time. And I want to thank you
absolutely
so much for giving us a few minutes. I'd love to pick your brain again down the line and whatnot. You have a bunch of other music projects. You have a bunch of other things going on. It's not just Jane's Addiction. It's not just Porno for Pyros. It's
absolutely,
there's a lot of things you got going on. So, you know, people might know you, you know, we put this episode out. Oh my God, it's a Jane's Addiction drummer, but there's also a lot of other things you're involved in. And I thought maybe you could tell people where to go check you out and what are some of the other bands you're in. And also what are some of the other projects you're working on?
Well, right now I'm working on launching a label, Perkins Palace. And you know, it's not about selling records because we don't sell records anymore.
No.
it's about finding great musicians and helping them cultivate the sound and the art and getting it out there. And that's a real quest of mine, to find new music and young and old musicians. It doesn't matter. I'm just looking for quality, you know. So Perkins Palace Records will be launched at the beginning of next year. You know, I've got a band with Mike Watt and Pete DiStefano from Porno. We call Hell Ride. It's a full punk rock experience. I've got a somewhat of a instrumental jazz band with Nels Klein and Money Mark and Mike Watt. It's called Banyan.
That's awesome.
I'm playing with these great girls, the Okai Sisters. It's a full on metal band. It's called Tabitha. You know, and I'm, and it's now I've been last year or two working with Danny Harrison, George's kid, and also the bass player from the Strokes, Nikolai, and that's called Summer Moon. And it's just constant because I like getting my fingers into pies and tasting different people, you know, and getting in there. I really enjoy it, you know?
Yeah.
And, and now I'm working with Think and Scott Page, the great sax player from Pink Floyd. So we've been doing Think Floyd, and we don't play like Pink Floyd, but we do Pink Floyd music. But I play with a little more muscle. So I listen to Nick Mason's drumming and I examine it, and then I bring my own flavor to it. And that's been a really wonderful experience.
Yeah, we had Scott on about 2 weeks ago.
2 weeks.
Exactly. Fantastic. So ThinkEX,
fantastic.
He's a great, smart, very, very enthusiastic musician. And, you know, like I said earlier in the interview, I always wanted to play with jazz players that played sax and trombone and flute and piano. And then hanging out with Scott Page has brought that to my world.
That's awesome.
There's many, many bands, many musicians. And I've got a 10-year-old son who's playing guitar. I just want to supply some good beats for him and let him write.
Yeah.
And and so, you know, and then if you know, to find me, you know, Stephen Perkins drummer on Instagram, at Stephen Perkins for Twitter. I'm always posting, I guess, in a sense, a positive, heartfelt message on those things. If I want to go social, I want to talk about what turns me on and what's going to turn on more players, just like Perkins Palace Records. I just want to meet new musicians and help them get the music out.
That's awesome. Steve, thanks so much for your time, man. And really stay safe out there. And hopefully before you know it, you're rocking Lollapalooza again before you know.
Sounds good to me, man. Thank you so much.
Technically, you just did.
That's right.
In
August. We did the stream.
Yeah.
And you know what's cool? Porno for Pyros hadn't played for 24 years.
Wow, it's been that long.
We did the porno songs on a front lawn in Laurel Canyon. And then Jane's Addiction, we went to a studio in L.A. called Third Encore, recorded 8 songs. And both of those experiences were like a B12 shot to my life, man. It was great for me.
God, 24 That's years. Awesome. You're making me feel Jesus. Steve, thanks so much, man. Stay safe out there, and we'll talk to you soon.
Peace. Thanks, man.
All right, Mike, Stephen Perkins.
Hell of a drummer. Hell of a guy.
Hell of a man. I'm sure you saying hell of a drummer is probably rated on his high list of compliments.
I expect to get a notation on his Wikipedia noting that. Like when they talk about, you know, he's a world-class drummer, as noted by Michael Berlew on the Verbal Shenanigans podcast. And then you get that little bracket with the number, and then you go down and boom, you get pressed to this episode of Verbal Shenanigans.
So that you're like under his like career highlights. It's like Michael Berlew said, hell of a drummer. And then underneath, oh, drummer for Jane's Addiction.
Yeah. Like if he has like a Grammy, he's going to like throw it off of his like bookcase and just put a frame of the Wikipedia with that note about my thoughts of his drumming.
Gotcha. Yeah, I'm sure that's going to happen. Funny story real quick. So one of the bits I did do on that comedy show, I forgot to mention, I was talking about how, like, so to get the baby to sleep, I put on, like, white noise. Like, just, and, like, it's like sounds of the uterus. You know, just boop, boop, boop. Now it sounds good on a cell phone and like a Bluetooth speaker or whatever. And like, you know, it's like today I get in my car, I plug my phone in to go to like, listen to podcasts on the way to work. I don't know if you've ever heard womb noises when you left your volume all the way up at like 50 or whatever the hell you were jamming to the day before. It is absolutely frightening. All of a sudden, I get in my car. It's like,
that's got to be like the weirdest insurance claim when you'd wreck your truck. Listen, I got in my car. Audio was a 50. My wife's uterus was going nuts. Long story short, I'm in a telephone pole. Okay.
Yeah. Now, I tried to tell that in a bit, and that was one of the jokes that absolutely, how do we say this? Didn't do anything. It did not. Well, here's the thing. It didn't translate on Zoom. I think that's like a sound effect kind of bit, like where you got to be live and get louder. And on Zoom, it doesn't. Mm-hmm. You get louder on Zoom, it's like distorts your microphone, you know? So, Mike, you might have a hard time with the volume, yeah. You know, you might blow out half the people's speakers and they're like, we can't hear the show anymore.
Yeah, they'd be like, why is that guy standing 20 feet away from the camera?
we can't see the first comic. Who
we can hear him clearly. We keep on yelling to turn him down.
Yeah.
God.
Mike, what do you got?
Scott, we've almost come to a very hard and hectic year. But I'm kind of curious to see how much you actually remember from this year.
Nothing.
So I came up with a cute little quick little quiz here on items that happened in 2020.
All right. All right. All right. So what do I got to do?
Well, I'm going to just give you the question. I'm going to give you multiple choice, and you guess which one
actually
is the answer.
Okay, got it. I'm ready.
All right. This is a weird, interesting one to start off with. What was the number one box office movie in the U.S. for 2020 by calendar gross? Is it A, Disney's Onward? Is it B, Jumanji, The Next Level? Is it C, 1917? Or is it D, Bad Boys for Life?
Wow. That's a tough question. I always assume these Disney movies murder because we always forget the kid, you know, how many kids go and see these movies and families. Bad Boys, I don't remember like massive reaction to it. 1917, I heard people liked it. It's still a movie I want to see. And what was the fourth option?
Jumanji, The Next Level.
I'm going with Jumanji just for the pure fact that The Rock and Kevin Hart are in it. I'm going to go with Jumanji.
Scott, as amazing as it sounds, Will Smith
wow,
and
Bad
Martin
Boys.
Lawrence had the number one movie of the year. They wow. made $204 million. Side note, as you were bringing up Disney, they made $61 million because it opened in March. So basically,
okay, right there.
As it went to the theaters, oops, that's when they had to kind of pull it back.
Was that the one with like the person with like invisible, like their dad turned invisible or something like that?
Yeah, it's like a wizard world, and the dad, they basically did a spell to bring their dad back, but they only brought back his legs, so they had to go on this adventure to kind of bring him. The rest of it back because he can only come back for 24 hours.
I got to give him credit. That's a very original concept. So
yeah. Yeah. Normally when you talk about a dead dad that's only cut halfway off, doesn't scream Disney, but they pulled it off.
Right.
They pulled it off. Scott, as we all love football, can you tell me the only undefeated team of the second round of XFL history?
Dude,
I
couldn't tell you a team that won in XFL history.
Well, you got one for a chance, Scott.
All right.
You can tell me it's the Dallas Renegades. You can tell me it's the Houston Roughnecks. You can tell me it's the St. Louis Battlehawks. Or it was the Tampa Bay Vipers.
You could literally tell me, guess which one of these is an actual team, and I would have a hard time.
You weren't wearing your New York Guardians outfits everywhere in January.
Sorry. I'll go with the Battle Hawks.
Houston Roughnecks, Scotty.
That's what I said. It was a Zoom.
You said the Battle Hawks. It was a Zoom. Everybody remembers they were 3-2.
It was a Zoom translation thing. Bad connection.
All right. Election question for you, Scott. How many states voted to legalize marijuana for recreational use? Is it 2, 3, 4, or 5?
I want to go with 2.
Shockingly, 4.
Wow.
All passed.
New Jersey, of them, huh?
Arizona, South Dakota, and Montana all getting lit up in 2021.
That's fine. That's fine. Yeah. It's funny because, like, New Jersey, like, if you saw those four states on the map, you wouldn't guess, like, I don't know. New Jersey's a lot more rules and taxes and things like that. So I feel like it's a bigger pass in New Jersey. Montana, who cares? You could, like, I feel like I could get as, like, high as hell and still not run into a mountain.
I think that's legally the only reason to go to Montana.
Exactly.
I can't fathom, no, you got to come to Montana for the, and then something where you're like, nah.
See, I would like to go to Montana. I like, there's national parks there. It looks beautiful.
Oh, yeah. I would love to visit. I got a friend up there. You met her, Ashley. She was at my 40th birthday.
You're not going to visit because your next 87 vacations are in Disney World. So the only Montana you're visiting is if Epcot does
Epcot over the Montana. We got a little section for Montana. What is it? Well, it's just a bunch of guys smoking pot. All right, Scott, have you heard of Quibi?
Yes.
So Quibi launched in 2020. It's a short form show streaming service that had $1.75 billion in investments. Quibi is also shutting down their service later this year due to limited subscriptions.
No.
Yeah. So when that happens on December 1st, how long did Quibi last from launch date to closure with $1.75 billion invested? Was it 160 days, 200 days, 240 days, or 280 days?
And what was their whole thing? Really short, like, content?
Yeah, it was kind of like Snapchat meets YouTube kind of deal. Like, they had some shows that, like, they brought back Reno 911 on there, but their whole goal is to be like, you're going to get a television series, but it's only 10 minutes long.
Yeah. I'm going to go with 200 days total.
240, Scott. You got to give them some credit. Got to give them some credit. Come on now. $1.75 billion, you think it only last 200 days? Come on now.
Everyone here is like, please, you guys, please go on Quibi. Please put the podcast solely on Quibi.
We got like 6 days to make it happen. going back to the election, Scott, what state voted the most for Kanye West? Was it Tennessee, Colorado, Minnesota, or Utah?
Wow. My first instinct was it was going to be like California just because there's so many people there. There's no way it's Utah. I feel like they're so buttoned up over there, possibly. So what were the other three options were?
Tennessee, Colorado, Minnesota.
I feel like Colorado, they're baked all the time, so they got to be like, eh, Kanye, whatever. So I'm going with Colorado.
They gave him 8,000 votes, but our boys over in Tennessee gave him 10,000 votes.
Tennessee. Wow. I might have to bring that up for my Tennessee comedy show.
There you go. I gave you your opener.
Yeah,
look
right?
You. Scott, you're not doing too good.
What else is new?
Not doing great.
I think I've done good on like three of these quizzes before. So,
all right. In March of 2020, the last of the Australian wildfires were extinguished in New South Wales. When did these fires start? Was it July 2019, September 2019, November 2019, or January 2020?
So easy. November.
Is it really that easy?
No.
Scott, they started all the way back in July of 2019. They went 9 months with fires.
I remember someone the Buckleys. We interviewed the Buckleys and we were talking about
Buckleys and Kathy Tate. We asked them about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't have a time. I'm bad with time anyway. So
you're bad with quizzes too, Scott, because you're 0-for-6 on our final question. So I got my fingers crossed for you.
But I heard the final question is like a bonus one, and if you get it right, you get 7 rounds worth of points.
Okay, I guess that will bring the audience then. Mm-hmm. All right, to close it out, one of the biggest shows of 2020 as we all know, was Tiger King.
Yes.
Scott, how many years was Joe Exotic sentenced for the murder to hire scheme that he did for Carolyn Baskin? Was it 15 years? Was it 22 years? Was it 31 years? Or was it 48 years?
I'm between 15 and 22. I want to say 22.
Scott, in your weird logic of how these quizzes go, you just won 7 rounds.
Perfect score, everybody. Perfect score. Once again, dominating the quiz scene. 22 years for Joe Exotic. Once again, Scott wins the quizzes because he is that good. That's what it comes down to.
And make up the rules, you know it.
Well, listen, there were no rules going the other way either. If I lost, I didn't lose. There was nothing for me to win. So
it was the honor of like you could have like ended this call and be like, "Hey, babe, I got 5 out of 7 right on Burlew's quiz tonight."
And she would have been like, "Why were you wasting that time not taking care of our child?
And why did you wake me up to tell me that? 5 out of 7 is a great number.
And why don't you have clothes on? I don't get..."
I'm doing frog leaps, okay?
Burlew, before we go, I got to ask you a question.
All right.
So, you're a big NASCAR fan.
I am.
Huge NASCAR fan. Probably the biggest NASCAR fan I know.
All right.
Burlew,
are you going to ask me about a toaster strudel out of curiosity?
I am going to ask you about a toaster strudel.
Go on. tell our fans.
So I see this news story pop up, and immediately I think of Mike. I go, okay, we got to discuss this on a podcast.
Well, let's emphasize you thought of Mike because of the NASCAR part before we continue. Before we even move a muscle, he thought of this about Mike. Because it was NASCAR. You may continue with the story.
You know what's nice? I have the edit button, so I can just edit out what you just said. So, okay. So, you know the story, I assume. But the headline that popped out to me was NASCAR Truck Series racer wants you to know the swastika that he drew on a toaster strudel pastry was taking out of context. So, yeah. Now I don't even know how to say his name. Is it Josh Remu?
I want to say I don't really know the driver that well, but that's how I guess to say it.
Okay, so on Thursday, whatever day it was, NASCAR Josh Remu posted a photo of his evening snack with what looks like a racist design on it. Remo posted a photo to Snapchat showing a swastika design on his toaster strudel. First thought is, I didn't know people were still down with the toaster strudels. Like, I remember those when they came out when we were younger, and they were all the rage. You got the pack, you toast, and then you got the little plastic thing with the icing on it, and you would... I would always mess it up. I'd rip it open while it was hot, and it would just glob onto like one side of the toaster strudel, and I couldn't get it.
By the way, did you see the image? I'll just show it to you.
Yes, I did. It's
okay.
Clearly a swastika.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what else he could say it is. He could be like, yeah, it's a worm with long, bendy arms.
You all don't remember Earthworm Jim? This is clearly, I was a classic Sega player, and this is what Earthworm Jim looked like.
Now, the toaster strudels, I did learn, like, eventually the key was to poke a really tiny hole and then use it like you could squirt the icing to design. But it took me a long time to learn to master the toaster strudel. Also, I haven't heard of a toaster strudel in 15 years.
It's been a while. When the story first started, it's just like he suspended indefinitely, and it didn't come out like exactly what happened. And then it was like, oh, something put on social media. So your first thought is, okay, maybe because a couple guys who are conservative kind of pushed boundaries on their like Twitter and stuff like that, and that got them in trouble. So that was the first thought.
Right.
And it took like a good like 2 or 3 days to find out, because then it was like, oh, it was something you put on a Snapchat. And again, nobody specified. So again, you're like, what the hell could he done on Snapchat? Who does something on Snapchat that makes you lose your job?
Yeah.
And I honestly, God, I think it took like 4 or 5 days of me like trying to refresh this story before I finally found said image on there.
Well, let's not call him guilty yet, right? Let's hear from his side of the story. The 30-year-old driver said that what happened was, I made a toaster strudel. Can you imagine, like, you're doing a press conference and that's the first thing you got to lead with?
Yeah. Like, you think of the famous ones where it's like, I did not have sex with that woman, or I am not a crook. Nowhere in there did you figure in, like, famous historical press conferences, I was making a toaster strudel.
And it's impossible not to read this in a weird Southern accent. I'm sorry. What happened was, I was making...
I was making me a toaster strudel.
So I put icing on it. I put icing on it arbitrarily. So that, right away, he's trying to go for a vocab. I mean,
that's controversial, because that means sometimes he has a toaster strudel without that little frosting on there, which is a...
Yeah, without his Nazi frosting. That
alleged Nazi frosting. Come
I
on.
Can now, that this has become such a significant thing in my life, everything is crystal clear now in what I was thinking. He said, I was mindlessly putting icing on a toaster strudel, thinking about how I was going to arrange to get my daughter to daycare in the morning, because that's my responsibility. And I was flying out to Phoenix the next day. When I was done, I took a picture. I wrote snack time and posted it to Snapchat, which I had no idea it was even more than my immediate friend group. Right away, he's trying to share that thing with his weird racist friends, by the way. It's not even under my name.
Oh, honey, get in here. Josh sent us another toaster strudel. Wonder what's on it today.
He did it again. He put a noose on it last week. This week, he's got a strudel. You know, a couple weeks ago, he had the All Lives Matter strudel. It's amazing.
He got a cherry, a strawberry, and a blueberry. He put a letter K on all three of them.
Yeah. It's not
took
even
a bit, but you got it.
It's not even under my name, to my knowledge. Now, shame on me for maybe not fully understanding Snapchat, and I don't care to get on social media in the immediate future, but somebody obviously screenshotted it or did something with it and pushed it to NASCAR. I don't know what the image looks like.
So I just love the phrase screenshotted.
Yep, screenshotted it, yep. He offered an apology, bro. From the absolute deepest part of my heart, I extend my condolences for how their family suffered. And I apologize how anything that has come out has offended them or stirred up memories or brought up pain in their life. I sympathize with them in any way that I can. I have my own family. I have uncles and grandfathers that fought in World War II. And thought what...
Which side?
And I thought what transpired during that time in the world is absolutely terrible. My view on that will never change. Nothing will change that. There's things you don't joke about, and that's one of them. When you have genocide, almost an entire people like that, 1 million-plus people, that's just not something... that's just not something that you say, oh, it's been long enough, let's joke about it. Great apology. Great apology by whatever his name is, Josh Remu. Berlu, what?
Actually, I think it's Josh Remy. Now I think about it, watching NASCAR, I think that's the same.
This is exactly what NASCAR needed, huh?
I mean, I will say the way he came out, it's sounding a lot like all right, he just drizzled it on there and that's what happened. And just one of those, like, a minute later after you realize what you did, it's like, oh, kind of deals. So yeah, I'm a little bit leaning on the, I kind of feel sorry for him kind of deals, but man, that's going to be a hard thing to defend right there. I mean, you imagine having like a Jewish grandmother who either like lived during that time or close to it and knows like the stories of it, that you have to explain to her an apology about a breakfast pastry.
It makes you wonder what other racist breakfast he's made.
Special KKK.
These are my Ku Klux eggs. yeah, this one is another one that I find it very hard. I see him backtracking real hard on him trying to make a stupid joke to his friends. That's what it was.
It's hard for me to say. Like, I mean, he's not like any kind of front runner or anything like that. So it's not like I hear a lot of interviews from him or they talk to him where I know like what seems to be the character of this person. So it's hard for me just on the NASCAR side to say, yes, he could be a racist. No, he made a really stupid mistake.
Yeah.
I think no matter what happens, there'll be no easy way to find the correct answer. I mean, NASCAR had to suspend him. I mean, I'm sure they'll listen to his case and at least put him through the same stuff, kind of like what Kyle Larson went through. If you might recall earlier this year, he was the driver who was in virtual races.
He was the driver that made the racist Kellogg's. He was.
He did something just as bad as equally stupid, where when the pandemic started and everybody was virtual racing, he was in like a group race and he thought it was on a private channel where he was like trying to talk to one of his guys. And it's like, Hey bud. You N word.
Right.
Where somebody in the race is kind of like, Kyle, you're on the public, radio station right now.
And I'm endorsing a new cereal called N Weirdos. It's,
it's basically alphabets with just the N letter. Boy, that's a sweet little southern dessert.
Boy, that tastes delicious. I love the taste of oppression in the morning to get my day started.
I mean the only thing I can say at the end of the day, I mean like I said, when you have what Kyle Larson did, when you had the news story earlier this year and the back pushback from banning the Confederate flag, you see something like that, your first thought has to be, oh, my God.
I feel like, Mike, you are within an hour distance of driving to some weird bakery and finding Nazi toaster strudels for sale. Let me get a dozen of those Nazi strudels.
Yeah, Scott, if you ever bring the wife down, don't go to Macon, Georgia. Really weird scene down there. Beautiful breakfast. I got to give them all thumbs up for that. But the message that they sent.
God, those Auschwitz sausages were to die for. Well, Mike, I don't know what's up with that one, but yeah. Imagine, it's funny because that one gets beaten under the, it's swept under the rug a little bit because it's, you know, NASCAR is big, but you know, it's not, as far as stretching as like the NFL. Can you imagine like, I don't know, Jameis Winston, some guy who always keeps messing up, did something like that, or Tom Brady made Nazi eggs. Can you imagine how big that would be?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, again, that speaks to this guy's a part-time driver in the truck series, which is like the third tier of NASCAR. So it's basically like saying, can you believe these double-A baseball players and their racist breakfasts? Kind of something to that effect.
Imagine Pat Mahomes loves ketchup so much, he's just making Nazi.
You put it on every spray? Oh, That's what makes it so good, man.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's been a fun time tonight. We learned a lot today, Mike. We learned how to do virtual comedy shows and how not to do virtual comedy shows. We learned about people's personal medical bills. We learned about the drummer from Jane's Addiction. We learned that
up for his drumming from Michael Berlew. Yeah. Remember that.
We learned I have no idea what year I'm in. And we learned that NASCAR makes some really great racist breakfasts.
And before we go, I will add one other nugget since we started the show with it. It's got the six teams on Legends of the Hidden Temple, the Red Jaguars, the Blue Barracudas, the Green Monkeys, the Orange Iguanas, the Purple Parrots, the Silver Snakes.
The only one I don't remember on that is the Red Jaguars. I don't.
Well, I remember the red shirts, but that's just so bland.
I know. They didn't even try there. They're like, we're not going to be the Red Rockets or the Red, I don't know.
They couldn't figure out a jungle animal to start with an R. So they're just like, God, you're Jaguars. Yeah,
whatever.
They're rampant. There you go.
Yeah, your team has no chance of putting that monkey together. Berlew, anything to promote before we roll?
I guess I'll just promote a local brewery down here that I go to a lot. Printer's Ale Manufacturing Company. Me and my wife go there usually about once a month. They got some excellent brews down there. We hung out with some friends. They have social distancing outside. They have a new tap room when that all opens up. It's available for people, but if you feel unsafe, they have a full outside environment with picnic tables so you can do social distancing. What was the beer I had recently? I'm trying to bring it up on my...
Racist lager. Delicious racist lager. Oh.
No, but I love this name. An IPA from New England that they have. Ben Affleck has a big, fat, stupid mouth. It was a very, it's a great name and a delicious beer. Highly recommend the place. Again, it's Printer's Ale Manufacturing Company in Carrollton, Georgia.
Absolutely. And I'm going to promote a good friend of the show. He did some amazing graphics for us that we use from time to time. He's an amazing caricature artist. I had him at my wedding to do caricatures. And that is comedian Mike Morris. He's been on the Howard Stern Show. He's been on a bunch of different amazing things. He opened for Lisa Lampanelli for years. He's hilarious, but he's also a super talented artist. He does these amazing caricatures and graphics for businesses and basically whatever you're looking for. Go to drawthelinestudios.com, Draw the Line Studios, or just look up Mike Morris or comic Mike Morris, and you'll find his work. He's super talented. He's a big friend of the show, and he murdered on the comedy show the other night. So go check him out. Guys, it's been another fun one. One of my favorites of the year. So what you could do if you did enjoy the show was you can go share the show, go leave a review on iTunes. That helps us get populated. And most of all, follow us on social media and all that, guys. Other than that, life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back. I will see you next week.
Go Silver Snakes.
Thank you very much.